I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. One of the more fascinating books of the season is Woo, The Monkey Who Inspired Emily Carr, written by Grant Hayter Menzies, who joins me now. The book is a terrific biography of a Javanese monkey whom Carr adopted in 1923. Woo connects with Carr in a special way and becomes part of her life and work. Grant chronicles Carr's relationship with Woo, as well as the other animals that Carr and her family surrounded themselves with. What's interesting about this book is how Mr. Hayter Menzies looks at our relationship with wild animals, especially bringing those into captivity. Incidentally, 40% of the royalties for this book will be donated to Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary in Sunderland, Ontario, which Grant visited. This book also gives the reader another chance to look at Carr's life, her work, and more. Grant Hayter Menzies has written many biographies, including books on women like Charlotte Greenwood and Billy Burke, Princess Derling, Sarah Pike Conger, Pauline Benton, Lillian Carter, and Dorothy Brooke. The Twitter handle for more is at Hayter Menzies. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Grant Hayter Menzies. Mr. Hayter Menzies, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So how do you, Grant, go about researching the life of a monkey?
I had a little practice. A few years ago, I published a book about a dog called Rags, who was the mascot messenger dog for the American 1st Division in World War I France. Mm-hmm. A children's book about him had been published in 1930, and I was always charmed by it. And then I realized, oh, wait a minute, he actually shows up in newspaper accounts, and this dog actually lived. After that, I found descendants of the officer who had looked after him after the war, and found that they had photographs and clippings, albums full of materials. They had his collar tag. He'd actually lived. Mm. And I went back and reappraised that first book and saw that it was actually based on field reports from World War I. And so it was like, wait a minute, I need to update this because the book stops after he came, after the end of World War I, and we know, found out that Rags had actually been smuggled over to the U.S. on a hospital ship and spent another 18 years or so of his life being fated by the 1st Division as the dog that got the messages through, and was a great inspiration to many veterans, and was buried with military honors in a pet cemetery outside of Washington, D.C. So that's the sort of a long answer to your question. This gave me an idea of how to approach writing about an animal that left, obviously, no written records, left no testimony, but they leave an impression, much the way, as I say in that book, people trying to write about medieval, charismatic people who lived in the medieval period who left no writings, left no materials whatsoever, and probably no pictures, nothing. And yet you can kind of build a portrait based on the effects that individual had on people, that were remembered and carried down to the present time. And so Emily Carr herself filled most of her book, The Heart of a Peacock, posthumously published book about her animals, with, I think most of the chapters are about Woo. Mm-hmm. So there's a great deal of material there. There's material in her letters. And from other people, you don't just stick with the person who was with the animal most of the time. You look and see what other people thought. And I found quite a bit of information. Not everybody liked Wu. Carr's sisters didn't care for her.
Yeah.
But a lot of people saw how important she was to Emily Carr.
Yeah.
And I think that's that's part of her, part of Wu's legend, as much as Wu is part of Carr's legend.
The Carr family themselves, they were rather wealthy, were they not?
Yes, the Richard Carr had made money provisioning gold miners who had come up to BC, and had made money in California as well as a provisions dealer. And he was actually an absolutely fascinating character. He did a lot of interesting things in his life than just fathering Emily Carr. So he seemed to really get her in terms of her artistic leanings. Mm-hmm. She always said, from him I received my great love of birds. And she was proud that her father refused to hunt, as I am, because mine refused to hunt.
Yeah.
So they lived an upper middle class existence.
So they obviously had a lot of animals around growing up, did they, Carr and her sisters?
They had pets that we would, you know, normal pets, as we would consider them now, dogs, cats. Would have been horses just because they needed to get around. They also had probably a few cows for milk. They had a field near their house, now completely covered by other houses in James Bay here in Victoria. One thing I noticed, though, in Emily's childhood was that when her mother died quite young, Emily's care, in a way, fell to the responsibility of her older sister, Edith, and the other sisters. And there was a great deal of disciplining of this child who, as I've described her, was sort of the monkey of the Carr family. She wasn't like her sister. She wasn't ladylike. She got her dress dirty. She couldn't be counted on to show all the best manners when they went to tea at other people's houses. And there was one case, and there may be more, of where an animal was actually taken away from her as punishment, which for somebody like Emily Carr would be about the worst thing you could do to her.
Right.
And that animal, a dog, was actually euthanized because the older sister, Edith, believed he was dangerous and that he would bite people.
Mm.
And it's interesting that Emily was in bed sick at the time and could do nothing about this, much the way she was in bed sick at the time in 1937, when she was persuaded that she had to give up her animals, that they were not going to help her recover her health, and that's when she was faced with the dilemma of what to do with Wu, because nobody wanted her, and nobody was supporting Emily in her her sickness and her weakness. To help her find a proper place for Wu to live. And that's how Wu ended up in the Stanley Park Zoo.
So we'll talk about that in just a sec. But
yeah.
It was 1923, I guess, when Carr and Wu got together, if you will. I mean, that's
yeah.
when Wu comes
yeah.
into her life. Now, what sort of a monkey is Wu? It's described as a Javanese macaque. Does that mean they are from Java?
Yeah, she was. She came up in a shipment from Java that was brought in by a local pet store dealer named Lucy Cowie. Mrs. Cowie would have them shipped up from San Francisco, mm-hmm. where they were kept, I believe, for quarantine purposes. So Wu would have come over as an infant on a ship with a lot of other monkeys and would have spent, I don't know, a few months, 3 months maybe, in San Francisco, and then shipped up to Victoria. Mrs. Cowie did a brisk business in the exotic animal trade in the 1920s. It was easy to do. Unfortunately, it's still too easy for people to get to acquire exotic animals.
And her business, I mean, it obviously did well because there were people buying these animals. Was that something common you'd see, say, in Victoria in that time?
There were a few other people who had monkeys. Of course, Mrs. Cowie had a monkey called Mitzi, who's referred to in Carr's writings. Mm-hmm. And there was a hotel sort of pub owner who lived and worked near the Carr house when Emily was a little girl. And this lady kept monkeys that were not chained. They would sometimes escape the hotel and run around the fields. And this is part of what gave the young Emily Carr a great terror of monkeys. She was so afraid of them that as a little girl, she wouldn't let her feet extend over the lower part of her bed because she was afraid a monkey was hiding there. It took her years to get over that.
And the nature of Carr and Wu's relationship, I mean, as soon as she acquires Wu, what develops in terms of say, their closeness, if you will, or how quickly does Wu acclimatize, if you will, if that's the right word, into Carr's lifestyle?
Yeah, I think, like any animal that you bring into your home, they look around to see what they need to do to adapt, what they need to do to survive in those surroundings. She was very young. She was probably no more than 2 years old, and she'd still have been with her mother. Mm-hmm. So here she sees this woman, this maternal female figure who looks after her all the time and who disciplines her, as Wu was disciplined. She wasn't allowed to do a lot of things that really are normal for monkeys to do, again, underscoring that it's not really right for a monkey to be in a house, in anybody's house. But what I think happened was Wu saw Carr as her mother, and she tried to emulate things that Carr did. Carr gave her lots of enrichment, what we call it now, activities. She treated her as if she could reason. She treated her as if she might enjoy the same things that a human child would do. Mm-hmm. She wore clothes. She put her in dresses not to dress her up, but because she was afraid she would get cold. It's very windy in James Bay, and she knew she was a tropical monkey. So, and she had all these animals to really grow up with, you might say.
Yeah.
Very, very rich and full life, as you know, best as could be afforded her, considering she really didn't belong any more than any wild animal does belong in a house.
You mentioned Carr's many pets, many animals. Was Wu perhaps the most influential on Carr's work, say?
I think, and this has come up a few times, I was an art critic and art journalist before I started writing books, and I grew up around art and artists, and I know something about what influences creativity in terms of applied art. And I feel that there was something, there's something in the Carr's work that becomes more fluid, more fluent, almost as if everything before Wu came into her life was quite dry, was quite well depicted, very almost photographic. Now, granted, her meeting with the group of seven, members of the group of seven, her discovery of Georgia O'Keeffe, of her understanding of abstract impressionism, did a great deal to help her. And Carr was incredibly well-educated as an artist. Mm-hmm. But something else happened, and it has to do with the way the figures suddenly become alive. All of the figures that she had painted at indigenous sites up the coast before World War One. After that, after the mid-1920s, they're just living figures suddenly. They're not just carved on poles, but they've got life in them, and there's something almost monkey-like about the sort of tension and ready to spring and, you know, a breathing quality to them. So who's to say that having this creature, this little being, human-like in so many ways, in her studio all the time, didn't have some effect on Carr as an artist, if by no other means, by being the alter ego, the Emily that could do whatever she wanted, who acted on impulse, who everything was honest and straightforward, and she, you know, as we could say of Wu, she didn't care what people thought. That's what Emily wanted to be like, and that's what she ended up being like. Mm-hmm. A biographer of Carr's, Dr. Phyllis Marie Jensen, mentioned to me recently that she felt that Wu was not meant to be part of the equipment of an eccentric artist. She was meant to be, that she was about Carr's openness and Carr's willingness to share her vision of the world with the public. And if, you know, that meant walking around Victoria with a monkey, you know, she wasn't doing it to be a spectacle. She was doing it to share.
Yeah. That's interesting you bring that up, because you mentioned earlier that the sisters didn't like Wu. How was Wu viewed by, say, the people that Carr encountered in Victoria?
Well, it was part of the it's considered part of the picture the complete picture of an eccentric individual to be to walk around with a lot of animals or to live with a lot of animals, but then to appear with you know, several of those dogs and a monkey pushing a baby carriage into downtown Victoria to do her shopping. I've read accounts of people who were with Carr, friends who were with her, remembering how she was laughed at in the streets. People did a lot of curtain twitching. Mm-hmm. There was one case where a young student of Carr's, Carol Pearson, remembered some people in the street actually yelling extremely unkind words at her. And this made Pearson upset, and she cried, and she said, "This is so unfair to you." And Emily said, "They are the ones to be pitied. They may have nothing to give joy in their lives." Hmm. I mean, I think that underscores the fact that Wu was about sharing the joy, not about making a spectacle.
Right, right. The other thing I enjoyed about your book a great deal, Grant, was how you sort of chronicle the social history of how humans view animals as pets. And I'm curious to know, after having written this book, and then I'm also thinking of, remember that IKEA monkey, which you mentioned in the book?
Oh, yes. Darwin.
Darwin, yeah. How has society changed, if you will, in terms of our relationship with animals as pets? I mean, has it evolved at all?
I think it's evolving, but one thing that I pointed out at my launch in Vancouver last week is that I still don't think they're taken seriously. Mm-hmm. One of the some of the events that happened when I was researching this book involved going to this to Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary in Ontario. It's located about 40 miles north of Toronto. A wonderful place where monkeys from some quite desperately sad backgrounds rescued from roadside zoos and exotic pet traders and discarded from show business and some that have come out of labs where they were experimented on are being taught how to live normally again, as normally as they can, to not be afraid anymore. And I learned about one of the residents there, Pockets Warhol, mm-hmm. who, unlike the others, is a monkey. He's a white-capped capuchin, about the size of Wu. He grew up in B.C. the way Wu did. He grew up in a house. He had other animals around him. He had a TV to watch. All that sort of enrichment for his time period, born in 1992, mm-hmm. that Wu had in hers in the 20s and 30s in Victoria. And yet when his human mother was unable to care for him anymore, she had options, which Emily didn't have. Mm-hmm. She searched across Canada to find a place where Pockets could have a happy life and a safe life, and she found Storybook Farm. Soon after arriving there, Pockets began painting pictures using child-safe paints. It was merely to give him something to do because he was showing some anxiety about being away from his former setting.
Yeah.
And he began that way, and now almost every weekend he's painting another picture or more. And the farm arranged for an auction or an exhibition of these paintings several years ago that brought in enough money to build a new barn for the rest of the animals to enjoy. And so Pockets just does this. I have a couple of Pockets paintings,
really?
And one of them is reproduced in the book.
Uh-huh.
I go back to what Dr. Jane Goodall has said about animal creativity, and that is, who are we to say that they don't have the same or similar urges to create, that they don't have the same or similar appreciation of something that is seen as beautiful or something that is seen as expressive of themselves. And so we talked quite a bit about this at the launch because of course, people were fascinated by his paintings, which are quite striking.
Yeah.
By his choices and his what seemed to be sort of established methods he uses when he paints. And like I say, we don't know what's going on here, but we know that it gives him pleasure. We know that the product is fascinating and quite beautiful. So I think one of the reasons I included this story in the book is that this is how seriously we need to see animals. We need to take what they feel and what they do seriously. And that's why I would like those who read the book to try to see what I'm doing with Carr and Wu, which is to take Wu seriously in Carr's creative life and the arc of her creative development, that she wasn't just a little primate clown.
Decoration for her life.
She wasn't a prop.
Right.
I think there are lots of artists who would agree with that. Frida Kahlo she depicted monkeys in many of her self-portraits, and they're not props. They are meant to be expressions of how she feels, how she feels about them, and how they all feel about their world. And I know that with my own dog, Freddie, who has followed me through so many adventures over the past several years, and really helped give me the emotional support I need to write.
Mm-hmm.
I know what the influence can be of an animal companion on a person, whether they're a writer or a painter or just making their way through life. They are very important.
Yeah, you that message is conveyed in the book a great deal, and especially in the part of the book where you talk about your visit to Sunderland.
Yes, a
portion of the royalties of this book, I understand, will go to Storybook Farm. Is that right?
Yes, I'm giving 40% of my royalties to them.
Yeah, it's so beautiful too in the book when you write about a storybook and your experience there, just what a place like that would have meant to Wu.
Oh God, yeah.
You know, had Wu ended up there rather than, as you mentioned a moment ago, in the Stanley Park Zoo.
Yeah, and I have to say, I went to Storybook Farm with one idea in mind, one purpose in mind, and I came away much enlightened in a way I didn't expect. I had a lot of resentment toward what had happened, had been allowed to happen to Wu. Resentment is not something that's logical. It doesn't make sense. It's really stupid to resent somebody who's dead because there's not much you can do about it. But I went there thinking, I've got to meet this monkey Pockets who had the life that Wu should have had. That's what I have to do. That will solve everything for me. What happened is, yes, I met Pockets, and I spent the first couple of days that I was at the farm, during which I was helping feed the monkeys and so on, talking to the volunteers. They're all women who keep the monkeys happy and fed and enriched, and telling them, oh, if only Wu could have had this, if only Wu could have had this. And at one point, one of the volunteers said to me, but don't you think Emily wanted happiness for Wu? Don't you think she loved her? Do you think that it didn't hurt Emily to lose her?
Mm.
And it came as a great shock to me. I actually had to go out. It had snowed and it was cold, and I had to go out and walk around in the snow because I really had not thought about that at all. And every time I looked in their faces, the faces of these kind, compassionate women,
mm-hmm.
I saw Emily Carr looking back at me
mm-hmm.
and basically saying, just try to understand me. Try to understand that I did the best I could, that I was in a difficult situation, and that I would like not to be judged, but just try to understand me.
Yeah.
And that's what led me to the idea, that revelation of going back to the apartment house that Carr had here in Victoria, which is still standing.
Uh-huh.
People still live in it. And asking the owner if I could go visit go roam around parts of the house
right.
and into the garden where Wu spent so many years of happiness. And that's when I really came to the conclusion that, the last words that are known to have been spoken by Emily Carr, she was dying, the last word was woo. In a semi-conscious state, a nurse overheard her in that state saying, just repeating the name over and over again. And the painting used on the cover of my book is one of the last that Carr worked on and is her last portrait of Wu. And significantly shows her not wearing a dress or engaged in some kind of domestic human, sort of human referenced activity, but sitting like a wild monkey in a tree. And I feel like, I feel like toward the end, Carr had come to grips with her own sense of maybe of guilt of what happened to Wu, and that she had done the best she could. And I think, I know, animals forgive. They forgive even when we don't deserve it.
Yeah. The by the way, you mentioned this apartment that you went to go visit.
Yes.
What is it like for people that live there now to know that Emily Carr once lived there?
I've not met any of the tenants who live there, but I of course know the owner of the building, and he and I went up into the attic where Carr at one point lived herself, so that she could rent out all the rooms, because she had a very hard time making a living as a landlady after the Great War, and saw the paintings that are still there, that the Haida eagles and frogs that Carr painted on the underside of the eaves, and these little things like the names of some of Carr's dogs. Penciled on the wall, with their weight and age, and then what are believed to be Wu's claw, not claw, but nail marks on different little wooden things that, like, there's a little partition between one part of the attic and the other, and there are obvious claw, obvious nail marks that could not have been made by any of the dogs. And it was the sort of thing that you would expect a monkey who was running around a lot and jumping and leaping to do. And I know, talking to the owner, he's aware that he has a very magical piece of real estate there. In so many ways. I've talked to people whose family members lived in the house. Those who remember or who were told about what it was like living with Carr usually have stories of how difficult Carr was as a landlady. She was under a lot of strain. We all understand it now, but at the time there were people who didn't like her. And unfortunately, there's still that, a bit of that, that, you know, that she was a bit Looney Tunes, and you just, if you know any artists who have to hold down a day job and that's still not paying the bills, then you know exactly how Looney Tunes that can become.
The other thing that the book does, other than give us this marvelous story about Wu, we in a way revisit Carr. I mean, it's been a while since she's been written about. Did you see writing this book as a chance to say, look back at Carr, maybe revise whatever we thought of her?
Yes, not just to, as I say in the book, to establish, in my view, that her animals were the fulcrum to her greatness as an artist, but to show how, yes, she's an icon now. She is visiting her grave. You feel like you're approaching one of history's great souls, and actually you are. She's a world-class artist, writer, individual. You could live the Emily Carr life and have a very happy. You could live that life and have a very happy existence. She was like, I think I say in the book, she was kind of like a grown-up Pippi Longstocking. Mm. And, you know, who didn't want to live like that? But I think I wanted to chronicle my my journey from misunderstanding what had happened, my resentment about what had happened to Wu, my outrage at the way animals always seem to pay the highest price for human failures. We can't seem to work it out so that they don't pay a price just because we screw up. You know, they shouldn't have to pay the price and be miserable. And I came to where I grew to love her and really enjoy her. She was lovable and enjoyable. She was brilliant. She was acerbic. She had wonderful wit, and she could teach us all today and for the foreseeable future about how to look after Mother Earth. So I got a lot out of it, and I hope the readers do as well.
And speaking as one reader of the book, I certainly did. You mentioned earlier a previous career as an art critic.
Yes.
When you look at Carr's work today, what does it make you feel, say?
I stand in front of any given Emily Carr landscape from the 1920s onward, and I feel like I've got a fresh gust of cool breeze blowing at me, and I feel her love for the earth, and I feel her love for nature, for trees. I grew up in a family where not only did we have a lot of pets, a lot of animal companions,
uh-huh.
but we were encouraged to, you know, if we loved a tree. I had a tree when I was a little boy that I loved very much. Spent a lot of time in the tree when I was upset, and it seemed to help me. And in these times when we see municipal governments making decisions about, you know, the tree canopy of their jurisdictions, and saying, well, this is for everyone's good that we, you know, pull down these trees to make way for a bike lane or a you know, whatever it is that's supposed to improve everything. I feel a visceral pain. I can't bear to see a tree cut down. And so I feel all of that. I think every single one of her paintings, like, you know, seeing her walking around with Wu, it's saying, you know, come and join me in this beautiful place where we live, and with these beautiful beings who are our animal brothers and sisters, and let's all be together in this and keep it safe.
You certainly given us a marvelous perspective in terms of Wu and Carr in writing this book, but that message that you just spoke about certainly comes through the book. It's a beautiful book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
On it.
Thank
Grant
you.
And I appreciate it. I kept you longer than I said it would. I could talk all day with you.
same here.
It's a great book, and you ought to be proud. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The book is called Wu, The Monkey Who Inspired Emily Carr. It is published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Grant Hader-Menzies. Join me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.